This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio Broadcast. Today, I will do part 3 of the first chapter of Jewish Supremacism as Spoken Word. We've had a lot of demand for this, and we've had a lot of reaction and very positive response in the first 2 parts of this chapter. Now here's the final part for your education and enlightenment. Please let me know what you think of this broadcast, and we will continue on with the book tomorrow. So here's part 3 of chapter 1 of Jewish Supremacism. In school, I brought up these fascinating facts with some of my teachers. They, in turn, were as incredulous as I had been. One suggested that the Jewish involvement in the Communist Revolution might have been the result of a long-running historical persecution of Jews by the Tsars, and indeed by much of the Russian intelligentsia. For instance, Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, and many other prominent Russian writers had criticized Jewish machinations in their books and articles. Russians didn't like the fact that Jews used the Russian language for doing business among Gentiles, but spoke Yiddish among themselves. Jews were accused of having an us-versus-them mentality rather than assimilating with the Christian majority. There had been a running feud between the Russians and the Jews for centuries, and from these conflicts arose pogroms to suppress the Jews. This war without borders can be illustrated by the Jewish reaction in the 1980s to the anti-Semitic Russian May Laws. The May Laws attempted to restrict Jews from some professions and mandate resettlement of most Jews to the original area of the empire, the Pale of Settlement. A huge area originally set up in 1772, encompassing an area about half the size of Western Europe, extending from the Crimea to the Baltic Sea, in which the Jews had been restricted. In retaliation, Jewish international financiers did their best to destroy the Russian economy. Encyclopedia Britannica describes what happened. The Russian May Laws were the most conspicuous legislative monument achieved by modern anti-Semitism. Their immediate result was the ruinous commercial depression which was felt all over the empire and which profoundly affected the national credit. The Russian minister was at his wits' end for money. Negotiations for a large loan were entered upon with the House of Rothschild, and a preliminary contract was signed when the finance minister was informed that unless the persecutions of the Jews were stopped, the great banking house would be compelled to withdraw from the operation. In response to the economic and other pressures put upon Russia, the Tsar issued an edict on September 3, 1882. In it, he stated, "For some time, the government has given its attention to the Jews and to their relations to the rest of the inhabitants of the empire, with a view of ascertaining the sad condition of the Christian inhabitants brought about by the conduct of Jews in business matters. With few exceptions, they have as a body devoted their attention not to enriching or benefiting the country, but to defrauding by their wiles its inhabitants, and particularly its poor inhabitants. This conduct of theirs has called forth protests on the part of the people, thought it a matter of urgency and justice to adopt stringent measures in order to put an end to the oppression practiced by the Jews on the inhabitants and to free the country from their malpractices, which were, as is known, the cause of the agitations." Unquote. So you see, Jews had ample reason to attempt to overturn the Tsarist government of Russia, and there is direct evidence that they did just that. The Jewish Communal Register of New York City of 1917 and 18, edited and published by the Jewish community, profiles Jacob Schiff, who at that time was one of the wealthiest men in the world, as head of the huge banking house of Kuhn, Loeb and Company. In the article states how the firm of Kuhn, Loeb and Company floated the large Japanese war loans of 1904-1905, thus making possible the Japanese victory over Russia. It goes on to say, "Mr. Schiff has always used his wealth and his influence in the basic interests of his people. He financed the enemies of the autocratic Russian Empire and used his financial influence to keep Russia away from the money market of the United States. Jacob Schiff actually gave somewhere between $17 million and $24 million to finance the Jewish communist revolutionaries in Russia, a sum that would be the equivalent of many hundreds of millions of dollars of today's dollar value. Rabbi Marvin S. Andelman, in his book, To Eliminate the Opiate, cites two sources documenting Schiff's financial support of the communist revolution and ultimate repayment by them. Jacob Schiff is credited with giving $20 million to the Bolshevik Revolution. A year after his death, the Bolsheviks deposited over 600 million rubles to Schiff's banking firm, Kuhn and Loeb. Unquote. It puzzled me that the violently anti-capitalist Communist Party would be supported by some of the most prominent capitalists in the world. But I finally realized that the Russian Revolution was not ultimately about the triumph of an economic ideology. It was about the culmination of an age-old struggle between two powerful peoples, the Jews and the Russians, in an ethnic war that tragically ended in the totalitarian tyranny of the communist dictatorship. Even worse, the score was ultimately settled in the terror of the blood-washed cellars of the Cheka and the frozen death of the gulags. The fact that supercapitalists such as Jacob Schiff could support a nakedly socialist regime such as communism made me question whether there was something more to communism than met the eye. What was it about communism that made it so attractive to Jews who were largely well-educated, non-proletarians, when communism was supposed to be, in Lenin's words, a, quote, dictatorship of the proletariat? Obviously, by and large, Jews were nothing like Marx's workers of the world, for no group was more involved in capitalism or the manipulation and use of capital than the Jewish community. I checked out the communist personalities that Maddie Smith told me were in the Jewish who's who in world Jewry, atheist Leon Trotsky, as well as atheist Maxim Litvinov, the Soviet Minister of Foreign Affairs, are proudly listed in the directory of famous Jews compiled by the leading Jewish rabbinical groups of the world. Winston Churchill, in his eloquent article, Zionism versus Bolshevism, A Struggle for the Soul of the Jewish People, had argued that communism and Zionism were distinct ideologies that were competing, as he put it, for the soul of the Jewish people. But something didn't seem quite kosher in the supposed titanic struggle, for it appeared that many Zionists also supported communism, and at least in the early years, many communists were sympathetic to Zionists. Millions of Jews, even supercapitalists such as Jacob Schiff, supported the communist revolution in Russia. The struggle seemed to be like that of two brothers who might sometimes argue between themselves, but who always stand together against their common enemies. In 1975, I read a book called Trotsky and the Jews, written by Joseph Nadava and published by the Jewish Publication Society, Philadelphia, 1971. The book points out that before the Russian Revolution, Leon Trotsky, born Lev Bronstein, used to play chess with Baron Rothschild of the famous Rothschild banking family. Quote, a Jewish journalist, M. Waldman, who knew Trotsky from the period of his stay in Vienna, when he used to play chess with Baron Rothschild in Café Centra and frequent Café Daily to read the press there. What could the Rothschilds, the biggest banking house in Europe, possibly have in common with a leader who wanted to destroy capitalism and private property? Conversely, why would a dedicated communist be a close friend of the most powerful capitalist oppressor in the world? Could it be that they saw communism and Zionism as two very different avenues to a similar goal of power and revenge against the czars? A number of questions arose. Could communism simply have been a tool they adapted to defeat and rule their Russian antagonists? Did the Jews believe they were in conflict with only Russians or with other peoples of the world as well? Was communism originally part of a strategic imperative that reached far beyond the confines of Soviet Russia? These were important questions. I thought that I might find their answers in the philosophical origins of communism. I resolved to investigate the ideological roots of communism. I found Das Kapital and the Communist Manifesto in my public library. Karl Marx's books were obtuse, especially the parts describing the Hegelian dialectic, but they made some sense if one believed that mankind had a machine-like nature as Marx theorized. One of my teachers made the oft-repeated, poorly thought-out comment that communism was great in theory but faulty in practice. To my way of thinking, to be a great idea, it must work in practice, and communism obviously doesn't. There has never been a theory that has promised more human happiness, yet delivered more poverty, mental and physical oppression, and more human misery and death. Until I looked into the foundations of communism, I'd always thought that Karl Marx was a German. In fact, I read that Marx's father was a Christian. Well, it turns out that his father, a successful lawyer, was a Jew who had converted to Christianity after an edict prohibited Jews from practicing law. Much later, in 1977, I read an article from the Chicago Jewish Sentinel boasting that Marx was the grandson of a rabbi and the descendant of Talmudic scholars for many generations. An excellent article in the Barnes Review points out the racism of Marx and Engels. Not only was Karl Marx from a long line of Talmudic scholars, he also hated Russians with a passion that could be described as pathological. I looked up Karl Marx in the Jewish encyclopedias, and I found to my amazement that the man who taught him many of the principles of communism was Moses Hess. As incredible as it might seem, contemporary Zionist leaders venerate Moses Hess as the forerunner of modern Zionism. The Encyclopedia of Zionism in Israel, under the entry for Moses Hess, is the following. Pioneer of modern socialism, social philosopher, and forerunner of Zionism, Hess was thus a forerunner of political and cultural Zionism, and of socialist Zionism in particular. He became deeply involved in the rising socialist movement. Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels acknowledge that they had learned much from him during the formative years of the movement. The Encyclopedia of Zionism in Israel, unquote. After months of reading from many major first-hand sources, I realized that the elderly lady at the offices of the Citizens Council had been essentially right, at least about the origins of the Communist Revolution. I felt as if I were sitting on the edge of a volcano. Every new piece of information seemed to both confirm and clarify the issue even further. In the last days of the Romanovs, Robert Wilton, on assignment for the London Times in Russia for 17 years, summed up the Russian Revolution in these words. The whole record of the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia is indelibly impressed with the stamp of an alien invasion. The murder of the Tsar, deliberately planned by the Jews Sverdlov and carried out by the Jews Goloshekin, Smoloftov, Safarov, Voykov, and Yurovsky, is the act not of the Russian people, but of this hostile invader. In 1990, a major Jewish New York publisher, the Free Press, a division of Simon & Schuster, published a book by Israeli historian Louis Rappaport called Stalin's War Against the Jews. In it, the author casually admits what we Gentiles are not supposed to know. Quote, many Jews were euphoric over their high representation in the new government. Lenin's first Politburo was dominated by men of Jewish origins. Also, under Lenin, Jews became involved in all aspects of the revolution, including its dirtiest work. Despite the communist vow to eradicate anti-Semitism, it spread rapidly after the revolution, partly because of the prominence of so many Jews in the Soviet administration, as well as in the traumatic and human Sovietization drives that followed. Historian Salo Baron has noted that an immensely disproportionate number of Jews joined the new Soviet secret police, the Cheka, and many of those who fell afoul of the Cheka would be shot by Jewish investigators. The collective leadership that emerged in Lenin's dying days was headed by the Jew Zinoviev, a loquacious, curly-headed, etc., etc. I began to realize that there was once widespread knowledge of the Jewish leadership of the Russian Revolution. An example of that can be found in the National Geographic magazine of May 1907 edition. An article entitled "The Revolution in Russia" describes the Jewish leadership of the terroristic communist revolution. Quote, "The revolutionary leaders nearly all belong to the Jewish race, and the most effective revolutionary agency is the Jewish Bund. The government has suffered more from that race than from all of its other subjects combined. Whenever a desperate deed is committed by it, it's always done by a Jew, and there's scarcely one loyal member of that race in the entire empire." Unquote. The facts were indisputable. An enormous fact of history has been wiped away from the intellectual consciousness of the West as thoroughly as a file can be erased from the hard disk of a desktop computer. In his classic novel, 1984, George Orwell wrote about historical truth going down the memory hole. This has been the fate of the truth regarding the real perpetrators of the Russian Revolution. I ask myself two questions. Why was the historical truth about the communist revolution suppressed? And how, in the free world, could that suppression have been accomplished? The first question had an obvious answer in the fact that the forces of international Jewry would not want it generally known that they were the primary authors of the most repressive and murderous evil in the history of mankind, communism. Obviously, knowledge of that fact does not create good public relations for Jews. The answer to the second question of how was more elusive. I realized that only very powerful forces could suppress important parts of the historical record and create a false impression of a, quote, Russian, unquote, revolution, when there were only 13 ethnic Russians in the highest levels of the first Bolshevik government. Obviously, the Jews historically did have a lot of power, as evidenced by Jacob Schiff, the Rothschilds, and others. But the power to change the perception of history, that seemed preposterous. Yet only a few months before, when Maddie Smith had told me at the Citizens Council that the Russian Revolution was Jewish, I had thought the idea was ridiculous. Now I knew differently. And I knew I was just beginning to discover a different reality in the world that was not mentioned by the New York Times. The facts I knew then led me to some interesting new questions. Does it make me an anti-Semite to accept the historical fact that the Russian Revolution was not actually Russian, but a takeover of Tsarist Russia by an antagonistic non-Russian nationality? Is there a historically proven nationalism among Jews hostile toward other peoples? The Jewish interests and the interests of the Christian West synchronize or conflict. If those interests sometimes conflict, did the well-coordinated worldwide Jewish effort to fiercely fight for their perceived ethnic interests in Russia have negative ramifications for Russia, Western Europe, and America? How did Jewish organized power create our special relationship with Israel in modern times? And finally, did asking these questions have anything to do with, quote, hate, unquote? When I saw programs on television about anti-Semitism, hate was almost always the word used to describe any negative opinion about Jews. I felt no hatred toward Jews. My investigation had been purely an intellectual exercise. I was an interloper looking into a world where I did not belong. But it was a world that intrigued me. Pondering the hate question, I asked a teacher at school why the word hate wasn't ever used by the media to describe the motivation of the mass murder of millions of Russian Christians in the Soviet Union. Certainly it would have taken a great deal of hate to have committed such monstrous crimes. She had no answer, and yet I had many more questions. In later years, I learned that labeling such inquiries hate was itself part of an organized effort to demonize anyone who would dare to oppose Jewish supremacist hatred of the Gentile world. Once I discovered the shared roots of both communism and Zionism, I decided to examine the history of the Jewish people, both historical Judaism and the development of modern Zionism. I felt that I had access to the best sources in the world for my investigation. I started with three excellent and exhaustive Jewish encyclopedias. And the next chapter is The Roots of Jewish Supremacism. Well, that's it, ladies and gentlemen. That's the first chapter of Jewish Supremacism for your enjoyment as spoken word. And tomorrow I will continue on with Chapter 2, The Roots of Jewish Supremacism. Please let your friends and neighbors know about this. People have been wanting a spoken version of this book for a long time, and now we're beginning to it, and piece by piece, chapter by chapter, paragraph by paragraph, we will complete this book and put it into a verbal and a powerful form available for a lot of those people who simply don't want to read, or those people who find it convenient to learn and become educated while they drive or while they do other things at work or whatever. You can take this broadcast, put it on MP3 or copy it over into cassette tape or CD, and there it is. You have this book on a portable, in a portable fashion, able to listen to it. It will make the miles go by very fast when you're driving somewhere in your car this summer. Thanks so much. I'll look forward to being with you again tomorrow with The Roots of Jewish Supremacism. Bye-bye now.
This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.davidduke.com.